Tatanka. Bernie Sanders has decisively won the Nevada Democratic caucuses, solidifying his lead for his party's presidential nomination. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports.
After a virtual tie in Iowa, victory in New Hampshire, and a clear win in Nevada, Senator Bernie Sanders called for party unity.
If we stand together, we will not only defeat Trump, we will transform this country and create a government and an economy that works for all of us, not wealthy campaign contributors. Thank you all very much.
Joe Biden, although a distant second, was upbeat.
You know, the press is ready to declare people dead quickly, but we're alive and we're coming back and we're going to win.
Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Just outside the White House this morning, President Donald Trump weighed in on yesterday's caucus.
No, I think it was a great win for Bernie Sanders. We'll see how it all turns out. They've got a lot of winning to do. I hope they treat him fairly. Frankly, I don't care who I run against. I just hope they treat him fairly.
President Trump is on his way to India today for a trade meeting with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. South Korea has raised its alert level for the corona disease to the highest level, and President Moon Jae-in urged officials to not hesitate to take unprecedented powerful measures to contain the outbreak. As new cases were reported Sunday, President Moon said the next few days will be crucial. Korea's Center for Disease Control and Prevention said of the 123 new cases reported today, South Korea now has 556 reported coronavirus cases. This is VOA News. People were desperately digging by hand in Turkey earlier today to reach survivors as at least 9 people died and 37 were injured in Turkey, where a magnitude 5.7 earthquake struck the border region with Iran. Turkish officials said schools in several villages were destroyed and about 25 ambulances, one rescue helicopter, and teams of medics made their way to the quake-hit region. Reports said the region is known for its powerful earthquakes. Iran's interior minister said on Sunday that turnout in the country's parliamentary election on February 21st was around 42%. State TV reported that participation since Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is the lowest ever. State TV also said that the former Tehran mayor Mohammad Bagher Kalimaf, a top contender for the post of parliamentary speaker, was the top winner in the capital with more than 1.2 million votes. A first group of 76 Ethiopian refugees have voluntarily returned home from Kenya's sprawling Kakuma camp this weekend. The UN Refugee Agency has organized this voluntary repatriation operation with the support of the UN Migration Agency. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The majority of refugees who have returned are from Ethiopia's Somali region. Many have been living in exile for up to 12 years. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than half of those returning in this first transport are women and children, including some who have been born and reared in the Kakuma refugee camp. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu tells VOA the refugees have fled persecution and instability in their country, but conditions have changed.
You're ready to go back home and return back to your country, to your community. So it's quite a big occasion. It's very significant.
The UNHCR expects to repatriate more than 4,000 other Ethiopian refugees from Kenya and 500 from Djibouti this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands more refugees are expected to return to their homes that they fled many years ago. It's a new beginning in South Sudan, a day after President Salva Kiir dissolved the previous government. Opposition leader Riek Machar, who has sworn in as his deputy, Kiir declared the country can now move forward.
We solemnly swear that we will work together to preserve the lives of our people and preserve their unity.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Joe Palca, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
They are changing now because we get yesterday in the night, we get some resistance from the many vote places from the north of the country, and now they are changing before sending the resistance to the city.
Togo opposition groups express concern about preliminary results of Saturday's presidential election.
You see, the French president lacks the moral and the legal capacity to call on President Obia to resolve the Aleppo crisis or to handle, to take care of the human rights situation on the ground. He, indirectly, is part of what is happening on the ground.
French President Emmanuel Macron plans to call Cameroonian President Paul Biya about the ongoing human rights violations in the Central African country.
Yeah, it's true that HRDC is planning to do vigils. Initially, we planned to do the vigils on Monday, but we are shifting it to Tuesday. We want to give the members of Parliament time to discuss about the recommendations of the court, of the Constitutional Court.
And a Malawian political pressure group plans to petition the Speaker of Parliament Tuesday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Agbeyome Kojo, presidential candidate for the opposition rally of the Togolese people, is holding talks with other opposition leaders to make a united decision about the results of Saturday's presidential election. Maxavi Carmel, communications director for Agbeyome, says reports show that the ruling party is rigging the votes in some parts of the country. His remarks come after security forces surrounded the home of Agbeyome shortly after the election ended. Civil and opposition parties condemned the move, saying this is yet another action to intimidate and harass the presidential candidate. For reaction, I reach Maxavi Carmel, communications director for opposition presidential candidate Agbeyome Kojo.
My candidate thinks that the organization is very bad because now we get some resistance from the central region and the south of the country, and we are sure that in the town of Lomé and the areas, maritime region in the south of Togo, we are the first. We are sure that we are the first. But in the north of the country, maybe in the Kara region, the president for Yasinge is the first, but they are going to change the
result. You think they will change the figures of the election?
They are changing now. They are changing now because we get yesterday in the night, we get some resistance from the many vote places from the north of the country, and now they are changing before sending the resistance to the city. I think they are changing all of them.
All right, so Max, have you contacted CNE, the Electoral Commission, to address this concern of changing of numbers of your candidate?
No. Yesterday, we had a press conference to the home of Agbeyome Kojo, and now we are waiting for the first proclamation because it's tomorrow. It's tomorrow. The National Electoral Commission will publish the result. We are waiting for that before decide to do what we can do. We have to use all the legal. I think we will use all the legal forces because the result in the north. For Nyasimbe is not able to win the presidential election. We are sure for that.
All right. So if nobody wins first round, is your candidate going to join forces with other opposition parties for the second round?
Yes, yes. All of us, we have to be together. We have to defend the election together. We cannot do anything alone. Agbeyome have to decide all things with them, with all the opposition candidates.
Mark Savi Carmel is the communications director for Togolese opposition presidential candidate Agbeyome Kojo. He spoke with me from the capital, Lome. A senator says French President Emmanuel Macron's concerns about the intolerable human rights violations in Cameroon appears to be too little, too late. Henry Kamendi from the main opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF, says Mr. Macron has remained silent for the last 4 years in spite of the Cameroonian government's refusal or inability to end the conflict. His remarks come after the French president said he will call to pressure Cameroonian President Paul Biya to end the crisis. For more reaction to the French president's pronouncement, I reached Senator Henry Kamendi in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
His reaction is in line with what we had all through said about the governance of Cameroon. We had often said that Cameroon is governed from abroad. He has just come to confirm the fact that he has a direct hand in governance as far as Cameroon is concerned. And the question then I ask is, why has he waited until now? And when is he going to make sure that he stops, that is a massacre, stops once and for all? Because we have heard of such statements before, people calling organizations, other heads of states calling the president of our country to order, or calling him to respect international and then law over human rights cases, but nothing has been effective for 3 years running. This is the fourth year going.
Some people are calling for the international community to put additional pressure on the Cameroonian government to help resolve this ongoing conflict in parts of the English-speaking Cameroon. What is your reaction?
Exactly. Well, my reaction is that the international community has been so indolent. Meanwhile, Cameroon, just like other states in Africa, was actually the creation of the international community, has been through the United Nations for them to have stayed quiet all this while. Why the damage is taking place on the ground, knowing that what we are talking is not tribal war, is not something which happened as a result of our tribal components in Africa, but as a result of the colonial interaction and the remnants of colonialism. And they ought to have come and known that they ought to have assumed responsibility that this is their creation, and that if we have Anglophones and Francophones, or if we have foreign colonials, if we had foreign colonials yesterday, and we had La République tomorrow yesterday, it was because of the French and the English. And under the United Nations, they decided to give them independence, one conditional, one without any conditions.
Senator Kamendi, a lot of people have called for dialogue, inclusive dialogue. However, the government is of the view that it has organized a dialogue where all sides participated, including most opposition and even some separatists, so to speak. So what other dialogue are people seeking?
You see, when we talk about dialogue, under the circumstances, except that we deny the existence of what we are living on the ground. If we deny the existence of an international conflict or a conflict that arises out of international law, namely that two countries or two peoples had their independence, one earlier than the other, and the other one subsequently had an independence that was actually conditioned on joining one of the independent countries around it. If we agree on that fact, that what is happening on the ground is a question of the independence of the various peoples at the end of colonization, then we will know that what took place here as a grand national dialogue or the major national dialogue wasn't a dialogue of that magnitude, wasn't a dialogue to handle the situation that is on the ground. Such a dialogue was supposed to have actually called on the international community to set in. Because we have a dialogue that is of an international magnitude. It is not because of the fact that we are looked upon now as de facto, as one country, that we will care less about the historical evolution of that country. The historical evolution of Cameroon shows that there are two countries in one. That there are two countries in one. Oh, there are two peoples who got their independence differently, who are living together. So the conflict that is underground shows that these two people who have their independence differently and who are living together, they are actually the subject of international law.
The French president said he's going to call President Paul Biya this week to put maximum pressure to resolve this concern of gross human rights violations in parts of the country currently ongoing. What are your expectations?
You see, the French president lacks the moral and the legal capacity to call on President Paul Biya to resolve the Alepon crisis or to handle, to take care of the human rights situation on the ground. He, indirectly, is part of what is happening on the ground. Because if he had said he was going to bring pressure to bear on the international community through the United Nations to look into the problem of the Anglophones in Cameroon, or to look into the independence of the Anglophones in Cameroon, so he should have actually said he will influence the international community or the United Nations to revisit the file of the type of the independence that was given the Southern Cameroons, and now it has become problematic to get the United Nations to resolve this problem once and for all.
Henry Kamende is a Cameroonian senator. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. Burundian opposition parties are expressing concern about the arrest of their members ahead of the upcoming May 20 election. The National Council for Liberty, or CNL, the main opposition party, says there's an increase in the arrest of its members after police arrested about 23 of them. The police say the arrest forms part of an ongoing investigation. However, civil society and opposition groups say the arrest is aimed to harass and intimidate opponents before the poll. For reaction to the arrest, I read Vital Nshimirimana, the Burundian leader of the Group for the Strengthening of Civil Society.
Yes, there is an increase of arrests around the territory of Burundi because of those who are targeted are mainly members of the opposition CNR party led by Gwasa. And now that Gwasa is ready to campaign for the presidential place in May, the ruling CNDD-FDD is very fearful of the candidate Gwasa, and it is retaliating against his members.
But the government has denied that this is what is happening and that those who were arrested were creating confusion and instability, and that is why they have to be arrested and investigated to ensure that the country remains peaceful.
Yeah, well, last week there was a kind of an armed group which showed around Bujumbura, but according to credible investigations, the group was formed by Imbonerakure to actually be a source of those arrests.
Burundi lawmakers on Wednesday passed a law declaring President Nkurunziza as the supreme guide for patriotism. What does this mean, and how are many Burundians reacting to this?
Raising Nkurunziza to the supreme guide for patriotism is an additional attempt for Nkurunziza to remain in power. Now he announced that he's leaving and that another president will be elected. But this shows that Nkurunziza wants to remain in charge, because leading the powers of the Supreme Guide for Patriotism, we see that he will be consulted on questions about national independence, strengthening patriotism, and national unity. And inside this, we can put everything in this chapter. So Nkurunziza will be a super president, and this will be a very strange kind of managing the country, the style of Iran.
Why do you say so?
We say so because Nkurunziza is thinking about putting a successor who will actually be respectful of the decisions of Nkurunziza. But according to the constitution of Burundi, the president should be at the top of the country. But now the supreme guide will be will go over the powers of the president.
But this was passed legitimately in the National Assembly. So why are people opposing this when what they did was lawful?
What the National Assembly did is very new, is strange, because this is one peculiar proposition which was proposed by the National Assembly, whereas other bills come from the government. This proposition was made from the parliament, and it was suggested to the government, and the government listened to the parliament, which voted. And it was initiated by the current speaker of the parliament, who was preparing to be the candidate, who was said to be one of the favorite potential candidates of the CNDD-FDD.
Vital Nshimirimana is the Burundian leader of the Group for the Strengthening of Civil Society. He spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. The Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, a Malawian political pressure group, plans to hold a protest march and a civil at the grounds of parliament on Tuesday. The group argues that its action forms part of the effort to pressure lawmakers to obey the judgment of the Constitutional Court, which called for electoral reforms. Gift Trappings, vice president for the HRDC, says members of the group will present a petition to the Speaker of Parliament to demand that the legislators comply with the judgment of the court. To learn more about the HRDC plans, I read Gift Trappings in the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Yeah, it's true that HRDC is planning to do vigils. Initially, we plan to do the vigils on Monday, but we are shifting it to Tuesday. We want to give the members of parliament time to discuss about the recommendations of the court, of the Constitutional Court. We want our democracy to be strengthened by the judgment of our court. We know that there are other members of parliament who want to criticize the good electoral bills, but Malawians want the 50 plus one as well. Malawians want to see fresh elections happening this year.
Why blame the parliamentarians for what you described as playing a game of not adhering to the order of the Constitutional Court when that order is being challenged in court?
I think at this moment we have this ruling of the court, of the Constitutional Court, and the other decision is not even there. So the court was given 21 days, but the 21 days is the decision tomorrow, on Monday. If the member of the parliament cannot comply to this court ruling as citizens, we are going to take them to court again for contempt of court, because this is the decision that the court made, and they have to comply with that.
So what will this vigil entail?
We want to petition the speaker, but also we want to send a strong message to the members of parliament. Actually, we are planning to have demonstrations in every constituency, starting from the north, for every member who has said no to democracy, who has said no to these bills, because we know that they are not there for Malawians, they are there for their own interests.
So what do you say to some parliamentarians who say it is their prayer to vote however which they feel is right. And that is why they are voting per the Constitution. If the Constitution allows them to vote in whichever way they want, why are you against what they are doing that is legal?
We know our politicians. This is Africa, and we know our politicians that they are there for their own interest. We know that mad exchange hands. We know that they are saving party interests, and we know that they are saving the interests of other individuals. And that is why, as people, as citizens, we are pushing these reforms. Why should someone deny for a president to be elected by a majority? We don't understand that. So we don't want people who would want to reinforce regionalism, to reinforce ethnicity. We want one in Malawi, and that is why some of us, we are pushing for these reforms. I come from the South, and I'm pushing for these reforms because I know that it will serve the best interests of our democracy.
You said that you know that money exchange hands. Are you saying some of these parliamentarians were bribed? Is this just a mere rumor, or you have proof of this?
Brother, this is true, and we know that in such kind of circumstances, money can exchange hands. We don't want to be beaten twice. I think you should remember that these laws were rejected in 2018. So we don't want to be slapped again in the face. And that is why some of us, and as well Malawians, want to see these laws passed. People should not politicize this because we know that our democracy has had gaps. And we can only strengthen our democracy with these reforms, regardless of political affiliations, but we want our members of parliament just to pass these laws.
Is the HRDC ready to go to court? Because it appears that what you are seeking for these parliamentarians to vote in favor of the order by the Constitutional Court appears not to be moving anywhere because some of the amendments were defeated in parliament.
We are ready to go to court. We have already instructed our lawyers to be on the loop. And we should assure Malawians that that's the direction that we would want to take. But as well, we are ready to have demonstrations in the constituencies where these members of parliament are coming from.
What is the aim of these demonstrations?
The aim is to send a strong message to members of parliament that Malawians want these radical reforms.
Gift Trappens is the vice president of the Malawian Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC. He spoke with me from Lilongwe. A first group of 76 Ethiopian refugees have voluntarily returned home from Kenya's sprawling Kakuma camp this week. The UN Refugee Agency has organized this voluntary repatriation operation with the support of the UN Migration Agency. It also says it expects to help thousands more to return to their homes they fled many years ago. For viewing, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The majority of refugees who've returned are from Ethiopia's Somali region. Many have been living in exile for up to 12 years. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than half of those returning in this first transport are women and children, including some who have been born and reared in the Kakuma refugee camp. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu tells VOA, the refugees have fled persecution and instability in their country, but conditions have changed. She says an increasing number of Ethiopian refugees have been asking the agency for help to voluntarily return home. She notes being able to return home after years in exile is a momentous occasion.
It means that conditions have changed and that you're ready to go back home and return back to your country, to your community. So it's quite a big occasion. It's very significant. And we know that there are many protracted refugee crises where many refugees don't have the chance to be able to return. So this is something, a very big milestone for these refugees.
Mantu says the UNHCR expects to repatriate more than 4,000 other Ethiopian refugees from Kenya and 500 from Djibouti this year. She attributes the surge in the numbers of those wishing to return home voluntarily to recent reforms in Ethiopia, which have improved the human rights and political situation in the country. The UNHCR is providing the returnees with travel money to get them back home after they arrive in Ethiopia. They also will receive cash assistance to help them reintegrate into their home communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, Florizel Lizia, President and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa, says the organization plans to hold its 13th U.S.-Africa Business Summit in Marrakech, Morocco this year. It is the leading U.S. business association focused solely on connecting business interests between the United States and Africa. In a sit-down interview, Ms. Lizia tells me that her organization is a platform for U.S. and African business and government leaders to engage, network, and explore new business opportunities and to advocate effective U.S.-Africa trade and investment policies.
The upcoming summit will be the 13th summit that CCA has organized. It is considered the preeminent conference on U.S.-Africa business and investment attended by government officials, as well as private sector CEOs and senior executives from across the continent, as well as here in the U.S. And we're looking forward to it for a variety of reasons. We believe that we'll have probably as many as 2,000 participants there to engage with each other, to explore business opportunities on the continent, and to do deals. And so, again, we see it as a critical conference that many people attend. Over the years, we've had more than 50 African heads of state that have attended, and more than 15,000 participants that have come to the U.S.-Africa Business Summit.
So this year, what will be the focus, and
yes,
what do you seek to achieve?
Yes. So the focus this year, our theme is on new pathways to U.S.-Africa business engagement. So what are we talking about? What new pathways? So I think you know that the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, has now become the Development Finance Corporation, DFC. A second pathway that we see as a new opportunity and pathway in U.S.-Africa business engagement, Ex-Im Bank will be able to work with U.S. companies to ship their products and services to Africa, and African companies that would like to purchase the high-quality products and services from U.S. partners will now be able to have the support of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. And those who are looking at developing Africa for their global and regional value chains will be able to now invest in Africa and trade with Africans as one large market. So these are new pathways that we will be highlighting at the 2020 summit in Marrakesh.
So talk to me about bridging the gap or building bridges between African and the U.S. companies.
For U.S. companies trying to get into that market and compete with companies from all around the world, we think that in terms of bridging the gap, what we're doing is we're highlighting the opportunities in Africa, the business opportunities in Africa for U.S. companies, so that they can feel, okay, this is what we have the opportunity to explore here on the continent. And then we're bringing the Africans to the table and saying, okay, here are American companies and potential partners. And then we're bringing government officials, both U.S. and African, who are responsible for creating the right environment, the laws, the regulations, et cetera, that can make it easier for U.S. companies to operate in and invest in Africa. We have programs like Prosper Africa, which have been rolled out. In fact, Prosper Africa was rolled out at our summit in Maputo, which are bringing all the U.S. government agencies together, all on the same page to say, okay, Company X, you want to go to country A in Africa? Here's what the U.S. government can do as a unit to actually help you and support that investment in Africa.
Florizel Desir is the president and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpoga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. There is a new WBC heavyweight boxing champion of the world. Tyson Fury prevailed over Deontay Wilder by seventh round technical knockout in one of the most anticipated rematches in recent boxing history on Saturday night at MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas. Fury, the Gypsy King, became WBC heavyweight champion once again, dominating Wilder before Wilder's corner threw in the towel in the seventh round. Fury outmatched Wilder in every way, dropping him multiple times in the fight and causing him to bleed out of his ear. In the end, the fight was a complete domination, nothing like the first bout. Nearly 15 months after their first meeting ended in controversy, there was no debating who the winner was in the rematch. Fury pummeled his rival in a way few could have imagined, following their 2018 draw, flooring him in the third and fifth rounds, while constantly backing up the most feared puncher in the division in a way no one has done before. Wilder was making his 11th defense, and it was his first loss ever in 44 fights. Wilder will now have 30 days to file for an immediate rematch, but Fury may look to make a unification bout with Anthony Joshua, who currently holds the other three recognized heavyweight belts. In African football, the Moroccan Football Federation has submitted a bid to host the finals of this year's Confederation of African Football, CAF, club competitions in both the elite African Champions League and the second-tier African Confederation Cup. It comes after a letter was sent by CAF to all national member associations asking for interested federations to send their bids before February 20th. Details must include training facilities which would be made available, accommodation plans, and a government guarantee. Morocco was the second African country, after South Africa, to express its intention to host the Champions League final on May 29th and the Confederation Cup final on May 24th. It will be the first time that CAF's two club competition finals will each be hosted as single matches, having previously been played home and away over two legs. Tunisia has also officially submitted a bid to host this year's CAF Champions League final. The announcement from the Tunisian Football Federation came on Thursday, the day CAF put forward as its deadline to receive bids. Two Tunisian clubs are in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, including four-time winners and current holders Esperance and Etoile du Sahel. But there are no Tunisian teams participating in the Confederation Cup, as both CS Sfaxienne and Gardena were eliminated at an early stage. Finally, in athletics, Ethiopia's Makwant Ayenu and Uganda's Juliet Chekwel captured commanding victories at the 36th Zurich Marathon on Sunday, with respective clockings of 2 hours 4 minutes and 46 seconds and 2 hours 23 minutes and 13 seconds. Although Ayenu had previously won marathons in Beijing and Venice, his pre-race personal best stood at 2:09, so his victory in Saville was something of a surprise. The 29-year-old took almost 2 minutes off the course record. Chekwel, meanwhile, was making her marathon debut, but also improved the course record by more than a minute. Her time took more than 9 minutes off the Ugandan record. Both men's and women's races had strong depth, as 7 men finished inside 2 hours 7 minutes and 14 broke the 2 hours 8 minutes barrier, while 7 women went sub 2:28, confirming the new course is conducive at fast times. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Have there been no hiccups during the peace process in the past 6+ years in South Sudan? The announcement yesterday that there would be a national unity government at the designated time period would have been hailed as a major achievement. But as it is, we are obliged to be a little cautious in the knowledge that South Sudan, the world's newest country, have enjoyed only 2 years of peace since its independence in 2011. And the agreement which has just been announced in Juba holds hope, and therefore we have to pray for not only the people of South Sudan, but the leaders themselves. The question has been raised as to why it has been possible at this time for the South Sudanese leaders to reach an agreement on a national unity government. The first one is that it had become clear to them that as they failed to meet this deadline, the international community may have abandoned South Sudan. Secondly, it has been reported that South Sudanese leaders were aware that United Nations Human Rights Commission was about to publish a damning report of massive corruption in South Sudan, which were to the detrimental of the humanitarian interests of the people. And thirdly, the new leadership in the Sudan has been encouraging the South Sudanese government to reach an agreement because this is an appropriate time for concluding the outstanding issues between the Sudan and South Sudan, particularly on the issue of Abyei. It may be recalled that in the treaty, the agreement, Abyei was to be resolved by a referendum, but there was no agreement as to who should vote in the referendum. Now, with a friendly government in Khartoum, this may be achieved. So I'm sure this may have been also a motivating factor with the leaders. But then we must also be aware that there are many issues which remain unresolved. The agreement itself was achieved in quick steps last week. At the African Union summit, it appeared that the Salva Kiir government and the faction of Riek Machar were too far away. But then IGAD made a proposal on a crucial logjam, the issue of the 10 states. They proposed that Salva Kiir should reduce the number of states he has created. He immediately rejected it. But then later on, he changed his mind and said he would accept the 10 states, but with 3 new administrative areas. While the Riek Machar faction accepted, the Riek Machar faction agreed to accept the 10 states, they questioned the setting up of the 3 administrative areas, mentioning that they may have certain ethnic implications that are detrimental to the faction of Riek Machar. But then suddenly, too, the matter was resolved. So we do not know whether there has been some kind of understanding between Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir as to how that matter should be resolved at a later stage. Then we have to think about the issue of the security of Riek Machar in Juba. This has been a very difficult issue and no solution has been found. Have they ever agreed now on how the first vice president, who was appointed just last week, how he will be protected and what will be his security? We have to wait and we have to see. This national unity government is a 3-year transition government, after which there will be general election. There are a lot of issues which have to be resolved. First of all, this government will have to complete arrangement of a national army. Secondly, President Salva Kiir had already dissolved the existing cabinet to make way for a new cabinet to accommodate personnel from the Riek Machar faction. It is interesting that President Salva Kiir already warned his supporters not to blame him if they are left out of the new cabinet. He did not explain what he meant by that. But this might also raise some difficulties in the future. So for the people of South Sudan and for their relatives, this government should try, first of all, to prepare the ground for the return of the thousands of refugees that have fled to neighboring countries, and to make sure that peace and security will reign in South Sudan. And this also a lesson for the rest of Africa. Achieving independence is just the first step. Maintaining law and order and the security of the individual is a major task. Frankly, South Sudanese leaders have not set a very good example. Let us hope that this decision made yesterday and will continue in the following weeks will show they have changed their minds to serve the people of South Sudan and not their interests or that of their ethnic group. This is the urgent task that awaits them. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you are hearing from Eddie Kenzo with Addicted. Rema Namakula follows with Gutuja. And then Bobby Wine, the famous Ugandan, ends it all with Afandi.
Make you a little touch, I make you a little grab, Kabulu jakuwa apande unaanzia kuwa mwananchi. muna kuni umiza, sikiliza neno langu. Shida ziko kwangu, pia nazo ziko kwako. I'm fighting for you and for me. Watoto wangu na watoto wako, wasome vizuri, wapate future njema. Madamu wangu na madamu wako, wazae vizuri, wapate matibabu njema. Inze kotulugu nyoto ni muganda wo, bino vienkola viyamba kwena bantubo. Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania. Sipigani nawe lakini nakupigania. Afande sirwana nawe be, nanirira kwe. Jirwana niwe mukagwa nanirira iwe. Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania. Sipigani nawe lakini nakupigania. Afande sirwana nawe be, nanirira kwe. Jirwana niwe mukagwa nanirira iwe. Afande pachalwe mkedi, afande achalwe mkedi. Kuna wakati wa kulipa, chote unapanda ndio utavuna. Bangi baba ndeo ngakwe bolimo, wewe wale sobiza bubola buse. Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania. Sipigani nawe lakini nakupigania. Afande sirwana nawe be, manirira kwe. Tiwana niwe mukagwa manirira iwe. Masikini hatoki alika ni mama inji ya pole. Why? Wadoba kubira kino na ena huli mtu. Mbele zipunyika na weze zipunyika. Usula bobe, ufuna bobe, na bantu bona bobali bobe. Menyoge la Kongo, nene la kona yenga chichenyo. Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania. Sipigani nawe lakini nakupigania. Afande sirwana nawe be, manirira kwe. Tiwana niwe mukagwa manirira iwe. Afande sipigani nawe, nakupigania. Sipigani nawe lakini nakupigania. Afande sirwana nawe be.
And that was Bobby Wine, the popular Ugandan musician and parliamentarian. That was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter and producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, quality beats do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe.